go there. Find as many weapons as we can. Claude came up behind him. We had lots of NLIs in the old soldier boys. The somewhat pacifistic weapons of non-lethal intent.
And some of them must still be intact.
Get them, then. Meet us over at E-Wing.
Let's take the fire escape,
Amelia said.
We can sneak around to E without going through the lobby.
Good. Do we have all the soldier boys? They started toward the fire escape.
4, Claude said. But the other 6 are harmless, immobilized.
Do the enemy shoes know yet?
Not yet.
Well, we can capitalize on that. Where's Eileen?
Down in the mess hall. She's trying to figure out a way to disarm the shoes without anybody getting hurt.
Yeah, good luck.
Julian opened the window and looked out cautiously. Nobody in sight. But then down the hall, the elevator pinged.
Everybody look away and cover your ears, Claude said.
When the elevator door opened, he launched a concussion grenade down the hall. The flash and bang blinded and deafened the shoes who had been sent to check on Blaisdell. They started shooting at random. Claude stepped between the firing and the window.
Better move, he said unnecessarily.
Julian was pushing Amelia through the window in an ungentlemanly way, and Marty was about to crawl over both of them. They pounded down the metal steps and sprinted toward the L of E-Wing. Claude fired scary bursts that just missed them, alternating machine gun and laser, that chewed up and scorched the ground to their left and right in the darkness. The people in E-Wing had already armed themselves as much as possible. There was a storage room with a rack of 6 M-31s and a box of grenades, and had improvised a defensive position by piling up mattresses in a shoulder-high semicircle at the end of the main corridor. Their lookout, fortunately, recognized Julian, so when they burst through the front door, they weren't mowed down by the distinctly unhumanized and completely terrified group behind the mattresses. Julian outlined the situation for them. Claude said that 2 of the soldier boys had gone outside to check on the remains of our original soldier boys, the ones with weapons of non-lethal intent. The current crop of soldier boys were peaceful types, but it's hard to express your pacifism with grenades and lasers. Tear gas and vomiting agent didn't kill, but it was less dangerous just to put people to sleep and collect their weapons. As long as the enemy's shoes stayed inside, that was a possibility. Unfortunately, Building 31 wasn't set up the way the Guadalajara Clinic and St. Bart's were, where you could maneuver people into the right room and push a button and knock them out. But 2 of the original soldier boys had been carrying crowd control canisters of Sweet Dreams, which was a combination knockout gas and euphoriant. You put them to sleep, and they wake up laughing. Both of those machines, though, were wreckage strewn along about 100 meters of beach. The 2 searchers sorted through the scattered junk pile and did come up with 3 intact gas canisters, but they were all identical modules. There was no way to tell whether they would make you sleep, or cry, or puke. With a normal cage hookup, the mechanics could have let out a little gas and smelled it, but they couldn't smell anything with the remote. They didn't have a lot of time to work on the problem, either. Blaisdell had covered his tracks well, so they weren't getting any long-distance calls from the Pentagon. But there was plenty of curiosity in Portobello itself. For a training exercise, aspects of it were profoundly real. 2 civilians had been injured by stray rounds. Most of the city was huddled in cellars. 4 squad cars of police ringed the entrance to the base, with 8 nervous officers hiding behind their cars, shouting, in English and Spanish, at a soldier boy guard that didn't respond. They couldn't know it was empty.
Be back in a minute.
The soldier boy controlled by Claude went rigid as its operator rotated to check out the 6 immobilized ones. When he got to the one at the front gate, he fired a few laser bursts at the tires of the squad cars, which made nice explosions.
He inhabited one in the mess hall for a few minutes while Eileen expedited a solution to the Lady and the Tiger canister problem. She took three prisoners, choosing among officers she didn't care for, and marched them down to the beach. It turned out that they did have one each of each variety. One colonel fell asleep blissfully, and another was blinded by tears. A general got to practice his projectile vomiting technique. Claude rotated back to E-Wing when Eileen's soldier boy walked into the mess hall with a gas canister under its arm.
"I think we're almost out of danger," he said. "Anybody know where we can find a few hundred yards of rope?"
I did know where some rope was stashed. Clothesline, in the laundry room. I guess in case all the dryers broke down at the same time. Thanks to my exalted former position in Building 31, I may have been the only person who knew about the rope, or where you could find three dusty cans of 12-year-old peanut butter. We waited a half hour for fans to blow out the residual sweet dreams, and then went into the mess hall to sort through friends and foe, disarming and tying up Blaisdell's troops. All men, it turned out, all built like fullbacks. There was enough of the sweet dreams hanging around to give you a little buzz, relaxing and uninhibiting. We stacked Blaisdell's commandos in pairs, face to face, assuming and hoping they would wake up in a homophobic panic. A side effect of sweet dreams for males is profound tumescence. One of the shoes had a bandolier of tumbler ammunition. I took it outside and sat on the steps, my head clearing as I shoved the rounds into the weapon's side port. There was a faint glow to the east. The sun was about to rise on a most interesting day. Maybe my last. Amelia came out and sat down next to me silently. She stroked my arm. "How are you doing?" I asked.
"I'm not a morning person."
She took my hand and kissed it.
"It must be hell on you."
I took my pills. I jammed the last round in and hefted it. "I killed a major general in cold blood. The army's going to hang me."
"It was as you told Claude," she said. "Self-defense, defending the whole world. The man was the worst kind of traitor imaginable."
"Save it for the court-martial." She leaned against me, crying softly. I put the gun down and held her. "I don't know what the hell's going to happen now. I don't think Marty does either." A stranger came running toward us, his hands in the air. I picked up the weapon and pointed it in his direction.
"This facility is closed to unauthorized personnel."
He stopped about 20 feet away, his hands still in the air.
"Sergeant Billy Reitz, sir, motor pool. What on earth is going on?"
"How did you get in here?"
"I just ran by the soldier boy. Nothing happened. What is all this craziness?"
"As I said..."
"I don't mean in there," he gestured wildly. "I mean out here."
Amelia and I looked out past the compound's fence. In the dim dawn light stood thousands of silent people, stark naked. The fewer than 20 individuals who comprised the 20 were able to solve interesting and subtle problems with their combined experience and intelligence. They'd had this enhanced ability from the first instant they were humanized. The thousands of POWs in the canal zone were a much larger entity, which only had two problems to work on. How do we get out of here? And what then? Getting out was so easy as to be almost trivial. Most of the labor in the camp was done by POWs. Together, they knew more about how it actually ran than did the soldiers and computers that ran it. Taking over the computers was simple, a matter of properly timing a simulated medical emergency in order to get the right woman, whom they knew to be kind-hearted, to leave her desk for a crucial minute. This was at 2 in the morning. By 2:30,
all the soldiers had been awakened at gunpoint and marched to a maximum security compound. They gave up without a shot being fired, which was not surprising, given that they faced thousands of apparently angry, armed enemy prisoners. They couldn't know that the enemy were not really angry and constitutionally unable to pull the trigger. None of the POWs knew how to operate a soldier boy, but they could turn them off from command and control and leave them immobile while they pried the mechanics out of their cages and took them down to join the shoes in prison. They left them plenty of prison food and water, and then went on to the next step. They could have simply escaped and dispersed, but then the war would go on, the war that had turned their peaceful, prosperous country into a strangled battlefield. They had to go to the enemy. They had to offer themselves. There were regular freight shipments between Portobello and CZ via monorail. They left their weapons behind, along with a few people who could speak perfect American English, to maintain for a few hours the illusion of a functioning POW camp, and crowded into a few freight cars manifested as fresh fruit and vegetables. As the cars pulled into the commissary station, they all undressed so as to present themselves as totally unarmed and vulnerable, and also to confuse the Americans, who were strange about nudity. Several of their number had been sent to the camp from Portobello, so when the doors opened and they stepped in unison into the shocked floodlights, they knew exactly where to go. Building 31. I watched the soldier boy at the guard box teeter for a second, and then swivel, taking in the magnitude of the phenomenon.
"What the hell is going on?" Claude's voice boomed out. "Que pasa?"
A wrinkled old man shuffled forward, holding a portable jack transfer box. A shoe rushed up behind him, raising an M31 butt first.
"Stop!"
Claude said, but it was too late. The butt plate smacked into the old man's skull with a cracking sound, and he skidded forward to lie at the soldier boy's feet, unconscious or dead. It was a scene the whole world would see the next day, and nothing Marty could have orchestrated would have had such an effect. The POWs turned to look at the shoe with expressions of quiet pity, forgiveness. The huge soldier boy knelt down and carefully scooped up the frail body, cradling him, and looked down at the shoe.
"He was just an old man, for Christ's sake," he said quietly.
And then a girl of about 12 picked the box up off the ground and pulled out one cable and offered it, wordlessly, to the soldier boy. It went down on one knee and accepted it, awkwardly plugging it in while not letting go of the old man. The girl plugged the other jack into her own skull. The sun comes up fast in Portobello, and for a couple of minutes that tableau lasted. Thousands of still people, and one machine in thoughtful communion. The street began to glow, gold and rose. Two shoes in hospital whites came up with a stretcher. Claude unjacked and gently lowered the body into their care.
"This is Juan José de Córdoba," he said in Spanish. "Remember his name, the first casualty of the last war."
He took the little girl's hand, and they walked toward the entrance. They did call it the last war, perhaps too optimistically, and there were tens of thousands more casualties. But Marty had predicted the course of it and the outcome pretty accurately. The POWs, who collectively called themselves Los Liberados, the freed, actually absorbed Marty and his group and led the way to peace. They started out with an impressive display of intellectual force. They deduced from first principles the nature of the signal that would turn off the Jupiter Project
and used a small radio telescope in Costa Rica to bleep the signal out there, saving the world. As an